I'm Sonia Mendoza from New York University, and I'm going to present on the impact of opioid prescriber surveillance on doctor-patient relationships and drug markets. And the PI is Dr. Helena Hansen, who is a psychiatrist and an anthropologist, so our approach is a little bit more qualitative. And I have no relationships to disclose. First, I'll again touch base on this opioid epidemic, prescription opioid epidemic, and touch more specifically on the pharmaceutical and policy responses to this, such as the prescription monitoring programs. Then I'll go into Staten Island as a case study, the increased transparency that New York's prescription monitoring program, iStop, and the movement between illicit drug markets and the rise of suburban and white opioid use, and how doctors are making sense of this transition. And I'll end with that discussion. So as we've touched upon before, the rise in prescription opioid overdose has skyrocketed, with it's tripled since the 1990s. And as a response, prescription opioids were reformulated to tamper-resistant and extended-release formulations. On one slide, you can see the original formulation, which could easily be crushed into a powder, injected and snorted or abused more readily. And the new tamper-resistant and extended-release formulation coagulates when it's tampered with. So there has, aside from the pharmaceutical response of changing the formulation of the prescription opioid, there has also been the prescription monitoring programs, which others have touched on. So 48 states have operational prescription monitoring programs. New Hampshire has legislation, but it hasn't been instated, and Missouri does not have any legislation, and I'm not quite sure why. New York State's prescription monitoring program is known as the Internet System for Tracking Overprescribing, and it was mandated in August 2013 that all prescribers enroll in iStop. And it's a registry for prescriptions of Schedule 2, 3, and 4 controlled substances. The doctor or a nurse can write in the patient's name and their birth date, and all of the prescription behavior is listed on this iStop. So there has been a policy response. So now I'll describe a little bit more about Staten Island, where most of our field work takes place, and where we recruited buprenorphine-certified doctors for interviews. Buprenorphine is a maintenance opioid that is prescribed from your general practitioner. So it's just a matter of being certified in prescribing buprenorphine, and it's for opioid maintenance. So those who have identified as opioid dependence as a problem. Staten Island is a suburban borough of New York City, and it has twice the landmass of Manhattan, but it only has 470,000 in population compared to Manhattan's 1.6, so it's very, very suburban in feeling. What is of interest to us is that Staten Island has 4 times the rate of opioid abuse of any other borough. Just as a backup, Staten Island has 4 distinct neighborhoods. But the main distinction is between the North Shore and the South Shore. The North Shore is more ethnically diverse, and about 81% of its population receives some sort of public assistance, compared to the South Shore, where only about 19% receive some sort of public assistance, but about nearly 70% of all buprenorphine prescriptions happen in the South Shore, even though providers and pharmacies are pretty much evenly distributed throughout the island. So this is to highlight that the types of patients that the prescribers that we interviewed are middle to high income patients. So again, this is a very qualitative study. We conducted semi-structured interviews with buprenorphine certified physicians. Through the SAMHSA list, you can find by zip code physicians who have gotten certification for buprenorphine. And we've also conducted ethnographic observations of the physicians' clinic settings and the neighborhood. The first field photo is a typical home of the South Shore, which are individual family homes. This one happens to have a sidewalk, but most don't, and there are arboretums that divide the different neighborhoods. And along with research assistants who come from medical and social science backgrounds, we go out there. It's an ongoing study, so we go out there about 8 hours a week, and we debrief biweekly on our findings. And the bottom photo is of a very symbolic graffiti we found on the side of a pharmacy that alludes to the relationship between patients and doctors. Very psychedelic kind of photo there. So one of the main findings was that physicians that we interviewed had a lot to say about the impact of prescription monitoring on their relationships with their patients. It's a small community, so a lot of these doctors know them from the neighborhood. And these are quotes that we've found. So iStop has increased the transparency of the behaviors of their patients. So a lot of them feel that as soon as they see any risky behavior on iStop, it's a reason to discharge them. One of them said, "It's the reason I have to discharge a lot of patients from my practice." And he would go on to say that he's discharged as many as 20% from his practice. And others are a little bit more blunt, and they see that iStop doesn't have any clear delineation of what to do if you do find some risky behavior or diversion on iStop. So he says, "The moment you find it on the moment you find it, you let them go. iStop is to detect diversion." However, some providers felt that iStop was affecting their relationships with their patients in a negative way, especially if they already established a relationship, where they feel that it's, in a harm reduction model, limiting their options for safe opioids, especially if they're physically dependent on the opioids. And the following quote exemplifies this. "I always took their word regardless of what they said. I gave them the benefit of the doubt, but now they can't lie to me, and now they have to go to heroin instead of opiates from the doctor down the road. So you're playing police and you're saying no to them more often, and their option for opiates are not there anymore." So this quote really exemplifies the bridge between going to your doctor and multiple doctors for opiates, and now because of the prescription monitoring program, the doctors see that there aren't no clear guidelines for them on how to address this issue, so they discharge them, and often without a clear referral to treatment program. And so this leads patients to go to illicit markets. So palpable more recently in this last year has been the bridge from patients from going to their doctor for opiates to illicit markets. And sometimes they doctors voice to us that it's the failings of the prescription monitoring program, where they wish it was a national program. For example, one physician said, "I get no access to New Jersey's thing, their prescription monitoring program." So they cross the bridge and they get a prescription. So if they want to do something, they do. And another physician, a little bit more bluntly, stated, "iStop has caused a major heroin problem in Staten Island. They turned a pill problem into a heroin problem." And the first photo here, you see a typical picture of a clinic in Staten Island. Actually, this one's a little bit more obvious because of the signs that they have, but most clinics really blend into the neighborhood. They have the architecture of their home, and usually without a clear post, maybe just the doctor's sign up on the door. And also striking to us is when we enter the clinics, some have clear postings or public service announcements about the prescription pill problem in Staten Island, but the other 50% have no sign that they offer buprenorphine treatment or that prescription pills are a problem in Staten Island. However, it's important to say that not all of the doctors have a negative impression of iStop. For some of them, it's beneficial if they have an established relationship with their patients. So they tend to biomedicalize the issue a little bit more and really focus on the idea that other doctors have been overprescribing and that they've become physically dependent on opioids. And this is a quote. "Some doctors are overprescribing, and then they leave people out on their own. These are smart Irish-American kids. They're smart and know right from wrong, and they didn't think they were doing anything wrong. The substances affect their judgment, and suddenly they start lying, cheating, stealing, even within family, and without having a criminal background." So there's a shifting of blame either from doctors who overprescribe or prescription monitoring programs that are limiting options, but doctors are worried and they do have a sense that this is really affecting the relationships they have with the established patients. A secondary finding was that although going to Staten Island, it's not an obvious problem, it's not like there are prescription pills on the floor or that people are dozing off on the streets, it has become palpable in the sense that when we approach a receptionist about our study, and we asked them if they want to participate. One of them responded to me, "What do you want to find out? Why everyone's so addicted?" And on another occasion, as we were going up and down Staten Island commuting, I overheard a group of friends in their early 20s, a group of males, who were talking about a friend who had just transitioned to heroin. And he said, "I thought he was just into pills, but he straight up told me he was doing heroin too." So there seems to be an undertone that pills were safe, and now the options are being limited. And there has also been public arrests. The photo here is of a Staten Island doctor's clinic that was attacked by a family member whose friend, a patient's family member died, and this family member went up to the door of the doctor and attacked his home. And we approached that the doctor's address was still in the SAMHSA list, and we went up there, and it was pretty dilapidated and has been kept that way. And another public arrest was of a YouTube video sensation. It was the Blue Fairy. Roxycontin is a blue pill. And there is Staten Island kids rapping about their abuse of prescription opioids. And she was later arrested for selling opioids to an undercover cop. There's also been popular media attention to the rise of opioids and heroin. And the press has recently published exposés on the New York Times and Rolling Stone magazine about the rise in heroin among unlikely suburban white users, and especially after Philip Seymour Hoffman's death earlier this year, there's been special media attention to the rise of heroin among this unlikely population. However, some studies would say that this is not that unlikely. A recent study by Cicero et al. Found that since the 1970s, whites have reported more heroin initiation than non-whites. And also, recent New York State data from the Department of Health have confirmed what the physicians expected. About 80% of heroin users abused prescription opioids in Staten Island before switching to heroin. And Staten Island residents have the highest rate of both unintentional prescription opioid deaths and heroin poisoning deaths. So overall, our ongoing study, ethnographic study, has found that ISTOP has increased the transparency and the comfort level of doctors with their patients, but it has also led to patient discharges when diversion is discovered. Also, doctors anticipated that patient state border crossing and heroin use would increase, and current data has shown that these blurring boundaries and of legitimate use and illicit drug use really is increasing the rise of heroin among this population.
I could ask our presenters to come up and sit here. We're going to engage in the question and answer portion of this. I think, not sure if we need to have the lights like this, but I think we've heard a lot of interesting presentations here, and if anybody comes away with the same conclusion I have, is that there are many rich data systems out there for exquisite epidemiological evaluations and analyses. I think the challenge for all of us is to take it to that next step as public health professionals and use these data to develop meaningful interventions to reduce the scope and magnitude of prescription drug abuse in the U.S. I think some of the data is very promising on prescription opioid overdose-related deaths. They may be trending down. Don't know for sure. I remember a description of the New York prescription monitoring program from physicians a few years ago as being totally worthless. They would not use it because you had to write a letter to get the data from the prescription monitoring program and then wait for the letter to come back. I mean, the response to come back, they weren't even using faxes. And now it's one of the most advanced systems in the country, and it's now mandated that the prescription monitoring program is accessed not just by prescribers but by dispensers, pharmacists as well. So it's an interesting model, and I think some of the information that you presented there is very illustrative on what to expect when these physicians, prescribers, and dispensers are forced to use these systems. And I have to tell you, I did work at SAMHSA for many years, and we did try to build these kind of this kind of helpful education information into prescription drug monitoring program interventions through specialized SBIRT programs that would screen and then take it to the next step after someone was identified at risk of prescription opioid misuse into a brief intervention and referral for treatment, not what you were reporting, discharging them from treatment right away with no alternatives. So we're going to open it up for questions. Under the rules of this, I'm supposed to repeat every question so it can be adequately recorded, and then we'll ask one of our excellent panelists here to respond to the questions. So, yes, ma'am.
Participating in field sharing networks. And as you stated, Tennessee is among the top five of the rise of prescription drug use. My question is to you is, has there been any particular stats on what's the best way to target women to decrease the rate of the rise of prescription drug use? Actually, the doctor shopping part, joining networks.
I don't know that there's...
Dr. Mayer, could you... Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
So the question is, are there interventions directed specifically to women? And I certainly there are programs that help women with substance abuse and things like that. That's probably a good place to turn. The work that we've done is really very broad right now in the interventions and focusing at that level of state policies and prescription drug monitoring programs. So at CDC, we haven't really been down into those interventions. It's largely more a function of the other, our sister agencies at SAMHSA, to work in the... Yeah, and I think that's it sounds like a great topic, and especially when you're talking about sharing drugs and keeping them around because you paid for them and maybe you need them later. So that sounds great.
Thank you.
Yes, right there, please. In the very back.
I have two questions about the South Carolina data. One is, can you distinguish where people see multiple providers, but all those providers are at the same, say, for example, federally qualified health center? And the second is, we've had a terrible problem in health equity in terms of poorer people being able to get even cancer opioid treatment, and so have you integrated to about what it was like before for very poor people to get cancer?
The question is relative to can I distinguish the provider types for those that are multiple users when I look at the claims data, and then how do we deal with those issues of individuals who rightfully should have higher prescriptions of opioids, such as those individuals with cancers, et cetera. One of the things that we do as part of our unit, the division that I head, is we have a unique relationship in that we geocode every single Medicaid provider, both registered with Medicaid, but also within the state that is affiliated with a managed care plan. The other thing we do is, and if it has been a different presentation, I would have shown you that within the context of the different providers. But one of the reasons this was part of our Birth Outcomes Initiative is because it is multi-agency, multiple providers with FQHCs and RHCs, rural health clinics, at the table. And so this allowed us to actually target and to work with individual entities and agencies and sub-providers related to the work that that is involved with what we found. One of the things we did is we did exclude that population that we felt was appropriate from this analysis, and those were some of the exclusions. So, for example, we excluded out cancer. We also excluded out sickle cell disease, which we see an awful lot of in South Carolina. And as individuals are doing this kind of work using this data, I would strongly recommend that you look at those populations of individuals for which those larger dosages are absolutely appropriate, as well as trying to understand the different levels of providers. What we found in South Carolina was that the larger numbers of providers that we found, and there was a group of women, roughly about 5% of that population, that had prescriptions related to hydrocortisone over 365 days, and those were primarily affiliated, started with OBGYN providers and then continued over time with other multiple providers. And so the first target for the Birth Outcomes Initiative was working with both the FQHCs as well as OBGYN providers in the state.
In the very back, sitting. The question is, in all the studies, are you asking the prescribers why they write narcotics?
So many.
Do any of our panelists have an answer for that? So I think in your explanation in there is that there's many factors, or including a few specific that you cite for the way prescribers and the amount of opioids they prescribe for the patient population. And I think if you look at some of the National Survey on Drug Use and Health Information, you see perhaps a trending down in non-medical use, and it might relate to interventions that target that very idea, that go to physicians with education. There's an extended release long-acting opioid REMS, a program that FDA instituted that addresses appropriate prescribing practices. It's mandatory education in some cases. So it kind of gets to the issue that too many opioids are being written for patients, and an effort to get a hold of that is through specific education. Any of our panelists have a reaction to that? Thanks. Yes, ma'am.
Preliminary numbers and said we have this much prescription opioid And they basically said, oh, we're prescribing way more than that. And when I asked them why, then a lot of the OBGYNs pointed the finger kind of at the ER doctors, and they said that when, and these are basically exactly what several different people said independently, that if a woman goes to the emergency room in her third trimester for any reason, she leaves with a prescription for Vicodin and Percocet. And when I asked for more information about why, it was kind of, you know, obviously most women in their third trimester are uncomfortable. They're having any kind of complaint, then discomfort is probably a part of that, and if you don't give them something, they're going to keep coming back. And you can't give, you know, your third trimester, for example, you can't give a lot of an NSAID or things like that. So it was kind of seen as a more benign option to keep the, kind of just to address the concerns, but also keep them from coming back. And it wasn't necessarily women that were showing up in the emergency room asking for narcotics or even necessarily complaining of pain, but they were getting those prescriptions just to give them something. Compared to a lot of other states, we have lower rates of opioids.
Thank you. It's a recurrent theme I've heard as well. Reducing discomfort is a reason for prescribing potent opioids. Yes, sir.
I guess I have a similar question for Ms. Hackman. These special population questions are all fascinating. So you have this young, multi-healthy population in college, but 50% of them started their abuse with the prescriptions. What are the reasons that they got their prescriptions?
We didn't specifically ask why were you prescribed this, but we did ask about injuries, if you've been injured within the last year, and quite a few people had actually indicated, yes, I've had at least, you know, some type of severe injury. So we assume that that's definitely part of it. But at the same time, if you think about the college population, they engage in lots of risky behaviors that may result in injuries. Also, they're very physically active, generally a lot more than the average population. And certain operations, such as taking your wisdom teeth out, things like that, happen around the college age. So we can kind of, without specifically asking, we can kind of surmise why people prescribe prescription analgesics in that population. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'd like to see more than people surmise. It'd be nice to have some good solid data.
Absolutely, I agree.
While you're up there, I had a quick clarification question.
Sure.
Did you say that 55% of your population were binge drinking in college?
It was 51.5%, and then there was a very large difference between the two schools.
Okay, but that wasn't a condition for selection in the study. That's just the prevalence
no.
rate.
Yeah. I don't know. pretty scary.
What was your definition of binge drinking?
So that was actually current binge drinking. So it was basically if you had, within one sitting, you as a female had four or more drinks in one sitting, or as a male you had five or more drinks, and then we also defined what we thought a drink was.
So that's per month or just any time?
Current was within the last month.
Within the last month, thank you. Other questions? Yeah. So one thing we can do about that is through the PDMP administrators, and this is something we did try, was to educate them on interventions so they would be a resource for physicians. You know, the physician signed up, got an account in the prescription drug monitoring program, got trained on how to use it to a certain extent. The next step is to let them know resources for interventions for these patients, the idea that they're not summarily discharged, but there is an attempt to get them into some treatment intervention. So that's something I think we all have to work on as public health professionals, educating prescribers on those treatment alternatives.
And also think about prescribers' perception of their liability.
Absolutely.
They know somebody was using, and they're not doing something definitive. We're creating a kind of bite in which our patients, and you know, I mean, it's very interesting that we have, almost all the data we have is on Medicaid patients, but when you look at the Staten Island data, and when I look at my practice, the largest explosion is in what appear to be non-Medicaid patients. And so we have to be careful that unintended consequences of what we're doing don't create new disease. That's why.
Interesting. Well, I would pose that question to Dr. Defiti. I mean, you had a percentage of your, in the Medicaid database, were visiting 4+ prescribers within a 1-month period for their Vicodin or whatever opioid they were prescribed. And of all the thresholds I've seen for doctor shopping, that pretty much satisfies a doctor shopper. Now, were they discontinued from Medicaid or discharged from treatment?
And so the issue for us is that that's really part of what the new framework is that was established in South Carolina. So I want to identify a major problem for us in South Carolina, and I believe it's also true for some other states, and that is that in order for us to link Medicaid data to the prescription monitoring drug program has been quite a challenge. And so one of the things that we had to do with this new legislation that was passed in South Carolina is to allow us to have that kind of access, because the number of prescription shopping in terms of prescribers also led to a series of questions for us, and that is how many of the patients that we saw were also getting these prescriptions, paying for them, outside of using their Medicaid cards and vice versa. The other issue, I think, that for a state like South Carolina, we tend to, when there's an economic downturn, recover 18 months after the rest of the nation. And so our Medicaid population and our rolls really reflect sort of this coming and going of the segment of the population that may be eligible for Medicaid, depending upon the economic downturns or so. And so for us, it was also clearly important to look at a piece of legislation that allowed us to look at individuals that could be tracked over time across different sources of insurance. I think the other thing for us as a state in South Carolina, we're one of the few states that has an all-payers data system. And so part of this legislation also allows us to look at this all-payer data system and allowed us to look at whether Medicaid is in fact indicative, or if the population findings could be generalized to what we're seeing in terms of the other payers. So I think in about a year from now, we'll be able to tell you a little bit more about this as a result of what has gone into law for us at this time. But it is a problem. And I understand that oftentimes it's a lot easier to look at the Medicaid population because of the claims data and its history. I think our challenge as a state right now is to look at whether those patterns are true, and of those who are in Medicaid, what does it mean? Your question as to whether they were taken off of the Medicaid rolls, no. However, they were steps are being put into place that allows them to be referred back to treatment. Steps are being taken in place to look at providers and to identify those providers for which there is a multitude of practices that potentially point to misuse. And then part of the group that's also part of this council is our medical association, as well as our hospital association and our pharmacy. And so the intent was to sort of put all the key stakeholders around the table with the same mission, therefore you would not have one organization sort of going against the other.
So I'm just curious for the different areas that where the research was conducted, what's the drug treatment landscape in those areas, and is there any effort to push more of a collaborative effort between the providers and the substance treatment
And so the question was the landscape of the providers, and was there an effort to sort of align them and associate them? So one of the reasons that we use geographical information systems so extensively is to sort of do those linkages and to look at that. The drug and alcohol and substance abuse program services have now been embedded into the Medicaid rubric. And so that's one piece of it. The other is that those providers that are not affiliated directly with Medicaid have been identified. And so the council also mandated that there be a report on treatment options and its movement in order to better identify gaps and to bring the people around the table to look at additional resources. One of the biggest challenges we face, though, quite frankly, around women of childbearing age is the treatment modality, and not having enough providers that understand how to deal with pregnant women when these issues come up. Issues of liability, issues of what is the appropriate level, as well as the Medicaid program currently funded two different hospitals in the state that have the highest numbers of births associated with babies born with a mom who is misusing. And to look at two different kinds of interventions and work both with babies as well as with mother, and then following them up for a period of 2 years afterwards. And so hopefully what you're seeing is learning more and also trying different techniques and strategies, both with child at the point of delivery, but also trying to link providers with that. There's also an ESPRT program that we have that is associated with this as well. And so we're trying a multitude of different methods to try and address the issue.
I was going to ask Sonia if she could follow up on that. I mean, I did participate in a task force that was pre-ISTOP in New York, and there were many, many treatment providers who were on that task force. And you provided anecdotes that said practitioners who discovered somebody who was doctor shopping through use of the ISTOP PDMP were summarily discharged from treatment. I don't think that was what was intended. So I'm wondering if there were any kind of educational outreach efforts that preceded implementation of ISTOP in New York that would look at, hey, you can't just summarily discharge somebody from treatment or abandon them. You must make arrangements for an intervention of some kind. Were there any of those?
Most buprenorphine certified physicians in Staten Island do not have any addiction psychiatry or addiction treatment training. There have been studies that in New York State, New York City, that doctors who are buprenorphine certified and have provider networks where they do know other buprenorphine certified physicians who they could turn to consult on how to follow up treatment, have had higher rates of even sticking with buprenorphine and continue to treating patients. But most of the physicians that we spoke to in Staten Island do not refer or consult with any other physicians. They are the only ones who provide buprenorphine that they know of in their immediate neighborhood. So they are little, and most of them have stated themselves, described themselves as islands. They're like, I'm a little island, and I don't consult with anyone for addiction treatment. There are referrals, but there aren't any contracts or clear plans as to how to follow up with patients if they do refer them to treatment centers. So that's an unfortunate thing that seems to happen with them.
Thank you.
I'm kind of curious about what the college landscape is like with regard to drug treatment, and if there was a component of the college
landscape. As far as drug treatment, I think it completely depends on the university. I know there are some universities that they have specific, especially alcohol-related, because binge drinking and alcohol is so prevalent on college campuses, but it completely depends on the university. Of course, we'd love to see comprehensive drug treatment programs because, of course, there is abuse, addiction, and dependence within the college setting, but again, I couldn't speak generally, just specifically on different schools.
We have time for one more question. Tracy?
consult, and the consult a line, which is a link on the Department of Health website where you can just click a link and have a phone. So you can have, if you're a physician and you are looking for addiction treatment, then you can call that phone number and in 30 minutes have, if you're concerned about a patient, perhaps send a PMP report or otherwise, and then have someone in your office in 30 minutes to conduct an assessment for their treatment and referral thereafter. So this does not address the fact that a clinician maybe doesn't have the capacity or the time to address problems that the patient might have, but it does acknowledge that there are other resources in the community that can better address those needs, perhaps at a primary care level. So that's one sort of one program. And then the other actually is one that we are evaluating as part of our patient-centered outcomes research institute grant, looking at our Medicaid program, which is looking at kind of a Washington-based model and creating community care programs. So there is both case management, patient navigation, peer navigation, and a walk-in program. And in particular, they looked at heavy emergency department utilizers, people with four or more visits to an ED within a 12-month period who had chronic pain. And Medicaid is actually paying for pump and treatment type of medicines, that chiropractic acupuncture and massage therapy. And we're evaluating them. We've talked with now 60 patients who are experiencing this. Their stories are incredible. Not necessarily replacing their pain management or opioid therapies, but an augmentation of and allowing them to get more long-term opioid therapy and pain management, health management, and allowing them to understand their bodies without having to necessarily have an opioid in the way that they understand their pain and pain relief. So it's kind of an interesting transformative approach that we haven't really talked a lot about in thinking about CAM and non-opioid-based pain medications, but one to maybe think about for your medical program as an alternative or a possible pilot, especially for a particular population that may deal with at the time.
Great. That's an excellent thought to conclude with. I do believe the resources are there, and it's our job as public health people to make sure the education gets out and that practitioners know of these resources. So I want to thank our panel for the excellent presentations on epidemiology. Thank you all very much.